Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Hey, thank you so much for joining me this hour. News anchor Howard Beale lost it, or maybe he's onto something. That's the question that opens up the Broadway adaptation of the 1976 Academy Award-winning film, Network. The stage version stars Bryan Cranston. Hi, Bryan.
Hi.
As Beale, who turns an irascible and jovial network news anchor who has some kind of encounter and decides that he's mad as hell and you know the rest. He threatens to commit suicide on the air. He talks to voices that aren't there. He rants about TV controlling our minds while on the TV. The head of the news division and Howard's best friend, Max, wants him off the air in treatment. But Diana, the ratings-hungry head of programming, thinks he is TV gold, whether he needs help or night. So night after night, Beale gets a captive audience for his screeds against capitalism, Washington, the TV generation, the very powers that have given him this platform in the first place. Staged innovatively, filled with explosive performances, and with much to say about America today as it did in the 70s, Network is a spectacle in every sense of the word. It's running through June 8th at the Belasco Theater, and Bryan Cranston and Tony Goldwyn join us now. Thanks for being in studio.
Thanks.
We really appreciate you coming down on a show day.
That's so, all right.
We get to have this conversation on public radio, where when we're trying to get people to
right, you guys are absolved.
Give us money and get, exactly, and get a tote bag in return.
Yes.
One thing we always talk about is how we're independent, and this thing was a satire, but it turned out to be prescient about news outlets purely as businesses, right? So I'm curious. That's sort of the obvious thing, but for both of you, what do you think is something else in the script that's not quite as obvious that's on the nose today?
Well, when I first did this play in London last year, it didn't occur to me quite as omnipresent as it did when we were starting the rehearsal period for the Broadway version of that. And that is the intrinsic value of anger. It is an emotion that most of us in society try to avoid. When we see someone publicly angry, we push away, we don't embrace that, we shun it to some degree. And for our human behavior, it's probably good to be tolerant and be accepting of different people and their way they live and choose to go about their lives. And if someone is angry, maybe at this point in our society, it is the appropriate emotion to display. There's a level of anxiety, I think, that is making all of us vibrate to some level of titillation in mm-hmm. some aspects. And it can be reverberate throughout, you know, our regular lives. We hear people talking about, I have to shut off the news. It's making me crazy. I have to go for a walk. There's so much of that going on that perhaps now is the time to scream out your windows, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. Anger is often a motivating factor to change. And if it can be the instigator to some social change, well, then I think it's well used.
It can be incredibly useful. That's why we have so many ladies in Congress.
Angry. and a lot of them are upset. And it is a good motivator to try to see what can possibly happen out of that.
The flip side of that's really true. But the flip side of that the play also explores, which is so true now, is that anger sells and is a hot commodity mm-hmm. and gets eyeballs. So what Paddy Chayefsky was writing about in 1976, when you got people in the 90s coming on TV like Morton Downey Jr. Mm. or Jerry Springer, or in the rise of Fox News, and you know, some of the both on both sides of the political spectrum, mm-hmm. whether it's Red State or Breitbart, you know, or you know, on the extremes of the left too. You know, people getting enraged on the air is very seductive and sells, and that's a big thing. You know, Diana says to Max, to mm-hmm. my character, you know, people, you know, want to harness the public rage. And that's, you know, so it's both. And that's mm-hmm. what's so interesting about it, because Brian's right. really right. Anger can be an incredibly productive and necessary change agent. One other thing, to answer your first question sure. that I thought of when you asked what else this play really explores in our modern media culture, what makes it so relevant is the how our obsession with our screens and media disconnect us from one another, you mm-hmm. know, the play really explores, you know, human relationships. All of these people, in a sense, become completely isolated, and kind of, you know, Howard is essentially utterly alone in the world. He and Max are kind of, in some sense, sort of separated. They're each other's lifeline. Max destroys his own family and all of his human connection, and Diana has been an island. That's her. The way she moves through the world is a lone wolf. So, you know, and the play really explores the consequences of that. And we're so titillated by mm-hmm. our virtual reality and so glued to it, to our screens, you know, that we live sometimes, some of us live virtual lives and have virtual relationships and virtual human connection, virtual sex, virtual everything.
Mm-hmm. Wait, get back to the virtual sex.
Let's talk about virtual sex.
Yeah, let's do that.
So I bought this doll. Wait, the people in the booth are starting to wave their hands.
My guests are Bryan Cranston and Tony Goldwyn. We're talking about Network, which is currently on Broadway. I want to pick up what you were saying, Tony, because it's you challenge the audience because there are so many screens, even in this production of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's do I look on the stage? Do I look at the screen? When I look at the screen, I'm having a different whole experience about what's being said versus watching the human being, Howard, saying it. I'm curious, when you were talking with the director about that, about when I'm performing this part, I'm performing it for stage, or am I performing it for one of the screens?
That's really outside the scope of an actor's interest, really. It's for an actor, it's just I want to communicate a specific message, and this is how I'm going to do it. Tony and I have both been in this business for a long time, stage and screen, so the idea of going from stage to screen used to be more of a leap, but now we're all mic'd, and I like the microphone. I don't know how you feel about it.
I like it,
Do you like being mic'd? They used to say, well, it's not authentic, you know, the actor of the old stage actor who used to be able to hit the back row, and that's fine, and that's a craft that you can develop with a booming voice, diaphragmatic breathing and all that. But the truth is that if you are doing an intimate scene, whether it's romantic or menacing or mm-hmm. something, you want to bring your voice down really low, and you can make a point. And if you could do that without having to hit that back row, I think it's more authentic. That being said, for the actor, we're just focusing on delivering the message. Am I communicating? Mm-hmm. Are my thoughts clear and concise in this? And leave it up to the production designer and the director to be able to say how they want to present that for the audience's experience. You know, it's interesting for us actors. They're saying, it's an amazing production, isn't it? And I go, I think so. I've never seen it, but I think it is.
Yeah.
You know? Right, because you're right in the center of all of it. All the cacophony, the visual cacophony around you isn't
we're not
in your business, actually.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, I found that it was a bit of a challenge with the differential between the camera and playing for a large theater. I think what Brian says is true. For me, I the way you modulate something, if you're typically acting in front of a camera, you can be very, very minimal and energetically intimate in a way that would never carry to a theater. And I feel, for me, that what we're doing is a bit of a hybrid. In other words, like Brian and I have this first scene where we're literally in the wings doing a scene that's with a camera right next to us and it's projected on a giant screen. And And yet our energy level and even our vocal energy level is, I would say, more, it is elevated. Mm-hmm. It's more, we're in a sense, and I did ask the director, I kind of drafted off what Brian was doing because he'd done the production before. So I was mm-hmm. like, okay, I'm gonna see where he's at. But I did ask the director or Danny, our assistant director, you know, and they're like, no, play it to the theater, feel the whole house as opposed to, you know, just being able to talk like this.
And that was fine because we're supposed to be in a bar.
That's true, yeah.
And the energy of a bar, drinking, you need to raise your volume.
Yeah.
You're drinking.
And yeah. But now I guess there are other things where people are literally completely off stage.
Yeah.
Tatiana's her phone call. You know, then there's a scene with Frank and Josh where they're literally just having a chat.
Yeah.
So that is, as you would do it literally on film or television.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting. And Tatiana and I have a scene out on the street live with a camera, and we walk right on stage from that. It's just a really interesting hybrid, but you're really right. It's not our job to kind of, we just try and be clear about.
Yeah, we have enough to think about.
That's right.
I'm curious, Tony, you do a lot of directing. You've done a lot of directing. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the big, giant directorial feat of this show that you're like, wow?
For me, just my impression, and again, I'm just trying to do my job, but what amazes me about our brilliant director, Ivo van Hove, is there was so much going on all the time in this production. There was so much stimulus and so much distraction, which is, I think, part of what he intends. There are screens all over, and you're not sure, you know, there's a lot to look at and to watch, and yet somehow he manages to guide the audience toward what they're supposed to be focusing on, even if he's teasing them to be distracted, mm-hmm. to create that tension between, well, I know I'm paying attention to this, but there's a screen over there with a commercial on it, or there's someone doing something over there. And what, you know, because we live in an ADD world, and I think that's part of the point he's making, but how as a director he's able to, you know, people have said this to me, have seen it, they say, I felt that, but I kind of knew what I was supposed to be watching. That amazes me in this production.
Brian, I'm curious, you mentioned earlier that you had done this in London before. Is there a difference between American and British audiences? Because so much of this is interactive.
The accent. Yes, that's the biggest difference. You know what's interesting? No, the British audience, I guess outside of the originators of theater in Greece, it's embedded in their DNA. They've been going to the theater for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I found even blue-collar workers go to the theater a lot, often, and they do, and they go religiously. I don't feel that that's as much the case in the States. I think certainly on Broadway, the cost is a consideration, certainly. And you'd like to think that there's a more of a cross-section of people attending the theater. And we're always thinking, how can we get students in? And we have rush tickets. And the Broadway community is concerned about that. And also, the Broadway community needs to invite the next generation of theater goer. And if it's cost prohibitive, then that's mm-hmm. going to hinder that quest. Because we need to instill the joy and the love of going to live theater as a way of life, not as a special occasion on our anniversary, we're going to go to a play mm-hmm. once every 5 or 10 years. No, we want theater goers to go. In London, they got it all. They have their own social unrest right now in terms of the Brexit mm-hmm. issue. Yeah, I found it pretty universal as far as the themes that we're talking about. The addiction to whatever the latest technology is. The spread of falsehoods and what is real news. And they're getting all of that. They're right with us. There are really wonderful theater audiences there, and as are here in New York.
As part of research, did you guys hang out at NBC or CNN or do any of that?
I didn't. I culled the experiences that I had watching for years and years. When I go on and do news interviews and see the normalcy of their work environment and how relaxed they are right before the seconds. And so I designed my Howard Beale to be preoccupied with other things and late on the set. They're always calling for him. Where's Howard? Get Howard. Well, you've been doing it for 35, 40 years. You're not in any hurry. And you're talking about something right up to the second of you're on. And he's in this case, Howard is a little irascible and he's complaining about a certain wardrobe malfunction and he's putting on his glasses and taking a sip of water and then he's on without hesitation. Just it goes right as fluidly as possible into the broadcast. And watching Howard K. Smith and Walter Cronkite and all these men, usually, that presented the world to us. And it was not lost on me that even in those days, news was packaged. It didn't strike me when I was watching it as a kid. I thought, no, this is all the news and they're telling you exactly what happened today. But someone was making a decision and hopefully free of their own ideologies. But that can't be the case. There, if you have 15 stories that you're going to tell and you only have time for 9 or 10, where's the cut?
It's all curated
it
by someone.
It is curated by someone. And even with the best intentions, there is probably some favoritism going on in that, even if it's subliminal. So it was a learning experience for me, and I'm glad I went through it.
As you're playing Max, Max is so loyal to Howard, and he really cares about him. And as you started to create this version of Max, what do you think's at the base of their loyalty? What is it that has these two guys? Especially Max there for Howard.
Well, for me, I think that, this is related to what your last question about, the world of news that Max and Howard came up in was, in the late 40s and 1950s and into the 60s, where there was a tremendous sense of, I think, purpose and a kind of moral compass, and we were the moral authority, and we had the responsibility and the power to kind of present the facts of the day to the American public, and that was a sacred thing. And these two guys came of age really in the age of Edward R. Murrow and McCarthyism, defeating McCarthyism. They both were came out of World War II. And were the greatest generation and perceived themselves, I think, in that way. Mm-hmm. And then as adults in the prime of their career went through the reported on the civil rights movement and the assassinations of the 1960s into the moon landing and ending in Watergate, really, which was just a couple of years before our play takes place. And now they're being pushed out because, news is becoming a moneymaker. And it was, not about ratings. So I feel there's a real brotherhood between them. It's a type of manhood, I think, that they have, which is very connected to that World War II generation. Mm. I think they both went through it. And, Howard's, a little bit older than Max, but in a little, I think he was sort of, to me, I always imagine Howard was like a big brother to me, but now I'm his, I suppose, a boss,
right.
And I think of people who are very focused on their work, whose work is something that's the central thing in their lives, you tend to, you have your family or your spouse, but these guys are all about their work. And so your brother in the trenches is, I have this line, I say, Howard Beale may be my best friend. And I always thought it was interesting that Max says, may be my best friend, because it's a kind of old-fashioned masculine way of expressing a deep emotion without sort of admitting emotion. I think Howard is absolutely his best and perhaps only real friend these days. So they just have a very deep connection, and Howard has suffered a tragic loss of his wife, and has, for a variety of reasons, I feel like one makes up one's own sort of backstory. So things that I've taken for granted as a reality, Brian may go, I don't think of it that way at all. Because we tend not to talk about this stuff. We just bring it into the work, you know. But I sort of imagine that we were at one time kings of the world. And now our network, as happens to all businesses, is in trouble financially. And the pressure is now coming to bear on our division. And Howard, who has recently suffered the loss of his wife and probably gone through some real depression, the ratings have gone down, and he's in trouble, you know. So Max feels this tremendous need to protect Howard and to hold the fort against the forces of change, which they view, and I think both of us view as corrupting and corrupt.
I think what's also added to that is a personal experience of Howard and Max feeling their relevancy slipping.
Yes.
Like they're getting to an age where, oh, we're now the old guys. We're now going to be put on a proverbial iceberg and sent off to...
And Brian, I feel that way in real life.
So. I was like, yeah, so it's... And that's really relevant to many people who watch this, and especially men who want to hold on. And at some point, you can't. You have to loosen that grip and allow the next chapter, the final chapter in your life, to be able to play out the way it's supposed to. And a lot of times that brings about depression, and that's where Howard is. Howard is riding in on this crest of depression, and he doesn't care. He probably should be fired. That's where we start the story, until he has this awakening, this epiphany, and it changes the whole dynamic of the show and the story.
My guests are Brian Cranston and Tony Goldwyn. We're talking about the Broadway adaptation of Network. We'll continue the conversation after a quick break. We're back on All of It with Brian Cranston and Tony Goldwyn. We're talking about the Network adaptation. Oh, the Broadway adaptation of Network. This is interesting. So I used to be a news anchor. I'm a recovered cable news anchor. Okay. And in sobriety 10
Congratulations.
Years. Congratulations. Thank you. So it's interesting. You know, I had a little PTSD when I saw the show in the beginning because I recognized the craziness and the makeup people coming and descending upon you, and you're trying to focus and you want to do one story, but the network wants you to do another story. And it was interesting. So I decided, I still have a lot of friends who are still working. So on my personal Facebook page, I said, hey, who's seen Network? Because I know they all went to see Network. And what questions do you have? So I have questions from real network news people for you. Okay, and some of them.
Maybe answers from fake network people.
This is from a producer on the Rachel Maddow Show. I want to ask Tony if they do that video scene where they walk on the street live every night, and if there are people who try to watch it from the street.
Yes.
We should point out, there's a scene where you exit the theater. It's unexpected, and your character and the executive slash side piece are walking down the street. So that's live every night.
Yes, it's live every night. We're out on 44th Street, and then we walk on stage and do a very unusual scene right after that on stage. It is always live, and yes, people have hilarious reactions as they walk by, because Ivo, our director, wanted it to be a completely live street. So there's no intervention at all. Whatever's happening on the street is what we're dealing with. And the camera's just walking with us and filming us. So people will stop and watch. They'll take pictures. They'll, you know, typical New Yorkers will walk by as we kiss on the street as if nothing is happening unusual. So you get all kinds of reactions. And the audience in the theater gets a huge laugh out of a lot of it. And some of it Tatiana and I are not even aware of, because we're in the scene.
This is from a producer at the Progressive News Networks. Patty Chayefsky's words were a searing combination of network television and a prophetic warning of what could lie ahead. We were, quote, mad as hell, but today his words seem more tragic as Fox News, InfoWars, YouTube broadcast their versions of Sybil the Soothsayer. What message does Brian hope the audience leaves with? Is it different from night to night?
I give a speech that is not in the movie, but is in the play, that Lee Hall, our playwright, who adapted the Patty Chayefsky screenplay. It is an amalgamation of Patty Chayefsky's responses when asked by the critics and reporters, why did you write Network? What does it mean to you? And he said, the thing that we must be most afraid of is the destructive power of absolute beliefs, that we've now formed a sort of ideological tribalism in segregating our groups and thinking that my group is right, therefore that group must be wrong. We're seeing this very evident in our politics today, where not only are they not crossing the aisle or cooperating with each other, but they're demeaning the other side and diminishing them and impugning their character often. This is tragic, and it is not going to help us advance any cause, any smart ideas. And even if Tony and I were on opposite sides of the ideological fence, I could not support a good idea that he may have simply because he's in a different party. This is crazy. And it has to erode at some point in order for us to really be progressive in our accomplishments.
The next one says, to you, just tell me he was a badass and should win a Tony for sure. So that's from Susan. That's just a comment.
Oh.
That was just a comment from one of my friends. This is from a documentary filmmaker. Oh, he worked on the Jimmy Breslin doc.
Oh.
For Cranston, it's such a physical and emotional role. How did you prepare for it? What do you do not to get burned out, both physically and emotionally?
Sleep, a cocktail after after an evening performance. No, it does take it out of you. I'm pretty exhausted throughout the run of a play. I'm attracted to characters that are damaged, and in doing theater, unlike doing film or television, you're telling the whole story every day, beginning, middle, and end. And a good piece of theater is emotionally demanding. And so you're giving it every bit of you, and you know, paying the price a little bit afterward. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a sporting event where you just go out and you're just focused on doing it, and you don't realize you're sore until the next day. That's kind of what we wake up with every morning. But telling the story is so valuable, and it's so great for an actor to be able to be on stage to do that. It's more rewarding for me than doing film or television in the actual acting part of it. You can have a greatly rewarding experience once a film is finished and you're feeling the full effects of it, but the process of it is very rewarding.
This is interesting. This is from one of Katie Kirk's former producers.
Oh,
I saw it. It was great. One thing I'd ask about is the decision to keep it in the period of the film rather than playing with the time and setting. What was gained by staying in the heyday of network TV? For example, the new Tootsie is set today, not in the 80s. I think that gets to your point, Tony, about at the time, these guys were the voice of God anchors. They were the lions of network news.
It's an interesting question. What Ivo Van Hove has done in the production is it is absolutely, first of all, it's very faithful, as Brian mentioned. Lee Hall, who's our playwright, is very faithful to Paddy Chayefsky. Mm-hmm. So Paddy Chayefsky's words set this in 1976. You know, the references the Paddy Hearst kidnapping and the different events of the day. So I think that, you know, defined it. Mm-hmm. You would have to change the script, which I think was, you know, they did not want to do. There's also a certain power, the design of the show, when you go into it, it feels at once, you feel that it's very much of the 70s, but there are elements that feel incredibly contemporary. And some of the equipment on stage are modern television monitors, modern cameras, some of the wardrobe, some people are in period costumes, and some of us are in modern, very modern suits. It sort of is a blend. And I think the impact is you feel that you're set in 1976 with those contextual references, and yet it feels absolutely contemporary and of now. And I think that tension, that sort of duality is really effective.
One of the things you mentioned it earlier, by the way, my guests are Bryan Cranston and Tony Goldwyn. We're talking about Network on Broadway. Is the part of the stage on the stage you you have audience members who sit on the stage in the bar.
They have dinner. Yeah, have dinner. Served a meal.
I'm just curious. Do people like sort of lean in and listen? I'm in previews. People, the word wasn't out yet in previews that this was happening. I'm wondering now that people know and understand, what kind of interactions you've had.
There are some who catch on. They start to play with us. A lot of people think that they're plants. That we have members of our company,
like extras,
yeah, in there, and they're responding appropriately. No, Ivo is not that way, and he loved the unknowingness of and the uncertainty of placing real people on stage eating and drinking alcohol during the play. It's like a level of dinner theater that is extensive, but yeah, there is some play, and my character has a chance to have some flexibility with that. And you know, I don't go out there each night thinking I'm going to go off the script. I really don't. But I look at Tony now because I do often go off. But you're supposed to respond to what's really alive and happening. Mm-hmm. And sometimes my mind gets taken by people and their behavior on stage with us. And you can't help but I can't help but comment on that. And
that was great. And Brian's so present in the situation. It's really fun to watch. The night before last, we have to start out with this bar scene, and we're talking about me having fired him, and we're having a drink at the bar. And there are two women at a table next to us looking at us instead of looking at the screen. And he's like, "These two ladies are looking at you, Max."
I'm your wingman, Max. Last time that happened, I got married. So let's not do that.
Last night when you went in the audience, apparently there was a lady with a fish head in her.
Oh, yeah.
What was that that you pulled out of her bag? Was that
at
a
one
fish
point,
head?
Yeah, at one
I couldn't
point
tell
you
what it was.
You come off the stage.
How'd you know
into
that?
The audience, because our producer Jordan went last night.
Oh, she went last
and
night.
She's like, "Allison, this lady had a doggy bag, and he opened it."
Is that
it.
What it was?
Yeah.
And there was
yeah.
a fish head.
There is a placeholder for me to go in the audience and do some ad-libs. We talked about it a lot. It's appropriate to the story. It's about how he's acquiesced to certain pressures and trying to convince the audience that we're all just bees in the hive. We're all the same. Let's stop trying to be individuals and just go along with the status quo. It's kind of a dangerous message. And so I go into the hive, as it were, and I sit down and I chat with a few people. And this woman had this big bag of something, and that's always curious to me. And I sit down between them and I pulled something out. It was a plastic doggy bag thing, a container. And I, "Oh, look at this." And I open it up and there was a fish head. And I looked
that's
at it and
amazing.
Went, "Okay, so that's never happened before." So I pick up the fish head and I start talking to the fish head and the audience is responding to it and I'm having fun. But you know, it's like, oh my God, I have to get on with it.
Why do you think she had a fish head in a takeout container?
Well, she was from Chile, and I'm thinking,
oh, interesting.
Maybe she was going to put it in a pot and make some fish stew.
I couldn't tell what it was on the monitor. I thought it was maybe a big sushi roller.
Yeah, no, it's a fish.
So funny.
The whole fish head.
It was a fish
head.
Wow. So, yeah, so it's a little crazy and fun, but it's fun to be able to have that moment when I don't know what I'm going to say or what's going to happen.
I'm not giving away too much, but at the end, we see some video of presidents. You both played presidents, real.
Yeah,
LBJ, mm-hmm. not real.
Yeah, right.
Fitz. And then you see all the presidents up mm-hmm. to 45. And I know the day I saw it, some guy got up and just started screaming at the screen when the current president came on. And someone made a comment yesterday that Rita Wilson was in the audience. And at that point, security came over and sort of helped her leave because the audience got so riled up. I'm just curious what you think about that, about do you see the audience? Do you see that reaction? You know, after watching this play, we've gone through this whole experience. I mean, is it cathartic for them to be able to get up and yell? Is it scary? I'm just curious what your response to it is.
Well, it's kind of twofold because the point that Paddy Chayefsky was making, what I mentioned earlier, is the danger of putting yourself encamped in any one particular thing, and that we need to get away from our devices, look at each other, discuss things, realize that someone with a different point of view is not an enemy, just has different ideas, and trying to find common ground. That's really the message of what Patty was saying. The end result, though, brilliantly put together, I think, by Jan Verzweveld, who is our production designer, and Ivo van Hove, our director, is to be able to say, no, look where we are. We are fully encamped. So we have a tendency now to watch and listen to those news programs, those outlets, those opinion programs that fortify our own belief system. And we nod and go, that's right, that's right. And that we listen or watch the enemy, so to speak, and we go, they're crazy, they're out to destroy the world. And I think that the swearing in ceremony at the end of the show just highlights where we are. And it actually is a little incendiary device to go, you think you're mad as hell? Watch this.
And the audience swallows the bait every night.
Audience swallows the bait every night, and they're, ah! By the way, Rita Wilson is a dear friend of ours, and she was just escorted out
to come backstage.
Oh, okay.
We weren't in fear of her protection or anything like that. It's all fine.
I'm glad everybody's safe. Yeah. My guests have been Brian Cranston and Tony Goldwyn. Network is currently running through June 8th. Brian and Tony, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Allison.
Coming up next, WNYC's culture editor Charlie Herman will join us with his picks for the weekend, as well as some music from La Luke. Stay with us. And now to all of its collaboration with the Academy of American Poets and its Poem A Day project. It's the only daily digital poetry series. The Academy invited 12 guest editors to each curate a month of poems in 2019. If you sign up at poets.org, a poem will appear in your inbox every day. And without further ado, here is today's poem.
My name is Craig Morgan Teicher, and this is my poem, Lifted. Well, I guess no one can have everything. I must learn to celebrate when I fail. Inner growth and fortitude follow the sting. Right? Won't I rise with holy wind in my sails? Yet they always seem to get what I want, door after door flung open. Why are the keepers of doors who haunt the hopeful halls of fate and desire so partial to them but not to me? Yes, I do feel sorry for myself. Don't, brother, pretend the bitter blanket of self-pity hasn't warmed your bones. It's not lovers or fame I crave, nor even happiness particularly, only to be lifted just once above all others.
If you'd like to have a poem a day in your life, sign up at poets.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.